give the sort of opening overview talk in this series. You know, we're trying to do a whole bunch of introduction talks today. And Mark's a great choice because it's a really fun talk with lots of movies.
we'll see about that.
And also for the experience in a wide range of different microscopies. Mark's done viruses, single particles, helices, 2D crystals, has done all kinds of microscopy. And on top of that is also a clinician who does heart surgeries. So he's just an amazing person.
Translation.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Bridget. I gave you all a handout of what I think are the salient points to take away from this presentation. We'll be covering several topics and several areas, and the idea is kind of the integration from atoms to cells. And what I'd like to cover is an overview of scales, starting from very big to very small, and then focusing on the topic of interest. I'll give a brief background of AFM so that you have a good understanding of cryo-EM, and then present several different specimens that exemplify the kinds of image processing that you'll be doing during the course: helical filaments, viruses, single particles, and also some examples of 2D crystals. In the characterization of living systems, ultimately we want to understand the chemistry, what's happening with water, amino acids, nucleotides, carbohydrates, lipids. And as you know, the organic molecules of life are organized in helices, an alpha helix shown here, crystal structure of superoxide dismutase solved in John Tainer's lab. Moving on to a higher order level of structure, you can see an immunoglobulin structure from Ian Wilson's lab, and that can be compared with the structure of reovirus solved by Kelly Dryden here, and this is about 600 angstroms or so in diameter, much larger. So this is a kind of specimen that's readily amenable to cryo-EM. But moving on, you can see that the virus is dwarfed by a virus, and compared to cells, you can barely see the virus. Of course, at the extreme, we have the universe. this beautiful picture retrieved from the web by Kelly Dryden of 10 billion light years. And at the other extreme, there was a paper published in Nature a few years ago where they used convergent electron diffraction and X-ray crystallography to derive this map of molecular orbitals. And we can also compare links and dimensions on this sort of scale. Carbon-nitrogen peptide bond, S1 fragment of myosin, ribosomes about 300 angstroms, diameter of an artery about 3 millimeters. Graduate students pay particular attention to the distance from the molecular biology building to the cafeteria and on down. And velocities, turnover, and events per second. I'm always amazed at catalysis, protein synthesis, and also movement of organelles within cells. It's remarkably fast. So I thought we would start at the organ level, if this plays. It's not going to, it looks like. Yeah, so this is an echocardiogram. Ultrasound passed through the chest wall, reflected back, and you get an image of the heart. This is actually the left ventricle, the right ventricle, the septum between the two ventricles. I'm afraid. Let's see if this goes. Basically, what I'll describe here is that there's a technique called Doppler echocardiography where you can also look at the reflection off red blood cells. And depending upon the direction, the signal is colorized, so you can tell if blood is moving towards you or away from you. And so that's also quite useful for characterizing blood flow in the heart. This is some of the latest technology in MR imaging. Obviously, here's the left ventricle, This is the aortic valve. And you see this jet of black during the contraction phase. So in fact, this aortic valve is leaking. Yeah, I'll just carry on. So this is an image from Pepe Jalife, and he's able to use voltage-dependent fluorescent dyes to characterize current flow in the heart. Quite valuable for looking at the distribution of voltage-gated channels and abnormal current flow. And imaging in the heart is performed in a cardiac catheterization laboratory. This is the X-ray source and the detector. Hold it down. Yeah, so real time you actually get an image of the vessels. All right.
A bit better.
And this is the kind of image that you see when we inject dye into the arteries, where you can see a constriction in this blood vessel here. And then we use a balloon with a cylindrical stent that's deployed in the artery to open the vessel. And you see blood flow restored. I actually brought one of these along if you want to see them. Please return this, though.
So, Mark, this is an X-ray scattering?
Yeah. Yes. So it's really fluoroscopy and then real-time imaging. Now, we can also pass catheters into the vessels of the heart. They're sort of 2.5-3 millimeters, and use that same ultrasound technique. And here we can interrogate the actual wall of the artery. This is the imaging catheter itself. And this cloudy echo that you see here is atherosclerosis, buildup of fat and cholesterol in the vessel. And then after deployment of the stent, you can see there's a large white lumen. But this process of blowing up the balloon elicits an inflammatory reaction, so that in some instances there can be proliferation of the smooth muscle cells that then block the artery. And that's the basis for the emergence of the drug-coated stents that we use now. And now, moving to higher resolution in vascular imaging, here you can see, obviously, red blood cells and this white cell that is binding to selectins and interrogating the vessel. So in looking at dynamics in living cells, macromolecules, there are a number of techniques that can be used. HD exchange with mass spectrometry, accessibility of antibody epitopes, and of course we make use of that in cryo-EM. Protease sensitivity, so you look at released peptides, and that tells you about those surface loops that are accessible to proteases. Spectroscopic techniques such as fluorescence and NMR, and imaging techniques that we'll be concentrating on here. So first a bit about AFM. Let me just mention that cryo-EM fills this resolution gap between high-resolution techniques such as X-ray crystallography and NMR spectroscopy and high-resolution cellular imaging provided by confocal microscopy. And AFM can be used to image surface topography. A particular advantage here is that the specimen can be maintained at room temperature and physiologic buffers. So we examine frozen specimens, but here with AFM you can actually look at room temperature physiological buffers and even change the physiological conditions. With cryo-EM, as you'll see, maps can routinely be obtained at 25 angstroms resolution or so. And if you have specimens with more orders, such as two-dimensional crystals, it's possible to achieve a resolution higher than 10, where you can resolve secondary structure and, in the best instances, atomic resolution. This is a cantilever tip in AFM. So this tip is deposited by electron beam deposition, and it's simply dragged across a surface. as you see here. And this shows kind of the relative dimension of this tip relative to the biological surface. And in the technique, there's exquisite resolution in Z because a laser is reflected off the cantilever, so you can measure that quite well. But you can see from the large size of the tip that the in-plane resolution is comparatively low. Even so, Andreas Engel has been able to record beautiful AFM images of two-dimensional crystals of an aquaporin in the lens. You can see the individual tetrameric structures. And this is a map derived at 5 angstroms resolution. This is one of the best examples, I think, of atomic force microscopy. Again, you're imaging the surface, so you really can't say anything about what the interior structure is. They've also examined bacteriorhodopsin crystals, in particular the extracellular surface. And that's another example where they could resolve sort of these individual domains. And these crystals did display fairly high resolution diffraction. So now let's move to cryo-EM. This is a gallery of structures solved in Tim Baker's group. And this enormous virus is 3,000 angstroms in diameter. It's huge. Moving on down to hundreds of angstroms. And then rotavirus is about 1,000 angstroms in diameter, moving on down to objects this size that we can also examine by cryo-EM. So we'll cover a few of these examples, and I point out that in moving from 1,000 angstroms down to 100 angstroms, you can imagine the enormous complexity and difficulty, technical difficulty, in examining such small objects. In conventional electron microscopy, you may know that specimens are embedded in a heavy metal, as you see here, and illuminated with the beam. And the contrast is provided by the heavy metal stain. The problem is that the specimens are dried and there's often deformation onto the carbon, as you see here. And so in cryo-EM, the EM grid is placed at the tip of the forceps, the specimen is applied, and it's blotted to near dryness, and then immediately plunged into an ethane slush. So the specimen freezes at about 1,000,000 degrees a second, and under these conditions, the water doesn't form ice crystals. Instead, it becomes vitrified, and it's a wonderful way to preserve native biological structure. This is the cryotransfer stage. The grid that you saw is here, and Dewar filled with liquid nitrogen, which is inserted into the electron microscope that you see here. So the specimens maintain at about minus 180 degrees during the experiment. And of course, one of the pioneers is here. Nigel was involved in the design of some of the early prototypes of cryostages. He obviously has an affinity for the snow, and he's probably contemplating the design of his next stage here. As you'll see in the course, there's a great deal of interest in automated microscopy because of the technical difficulty of performing cryo-EM. It can be very tedious. And Clint and Bridget will be telling you a lot more about robotic electron microscopy. They also have some funny stories when this thing gets out of hand. And you'll also hear about Legendon, where images are recorded automatically after setting up the imaging conditions. This is a field of tobacco mosaic virus particles. And you'll hear that structures can be solved very quickly, in this case, literally in 24 hours of data collection. The map was derived at about 10 angstroms resolution so that you could see the four helix bundle of the core protein of TMV. Let's talk now about some helical structures, actomyosin and microtubules. This is work from Velia Fowler's lab, just an overview of muscle structure, which you're all familiar with. Overlapping actin and myosin filaments with the Z bands here. And note the pointed and barbed ends of the actin. And Yeah, so she's able to image actin filaments in live cells. And have real-time dynamics. This is an image from Ron of actin decorated with myosin. You can see these characteristic barbed appearances. And by using helical reconstruction methods, you can derive maps at about 25 to 30 angstroms resolution. There were several structures that went into deriving this overall map that you see here, a number of difference maps, labeling, and so on. And as you'll hear, a powerful approach that we use is to take high-resolution structures solved by X-ray crystallography and use a low-resolution envelope provided by cryo-EM and dock the crystal structure into the EM map in order to build what we call pseudo-atomic models. This is work from Kevin Sullivan's lab imaging microtubules in living cells, obviously the mitotic apparatus. And this is from Claire Waterman's store, in which she's able to use digital microscopy to visualize the leading edge of a moving cell with the microtubules. It's really quite remarkable how quickly the filaments polymerize. And Ron's group has examined microtubules for a number of years, a beautiful cryo image from which you can use helical reconstruction methods to derive the bare microtubule, and you can also decorate it with motor proteins such as a monomer of NCD or a dimer of NCD and use difference map techniques to define the binding site of the motor on the microtubule. I also wanted to show this a very nice example of gold labeling to characterize the conformational changes in different ADP and nucleotide states. They specifically labeled residue 333 with gold and then could compute difference map with the unlabeled tubules to delineate the movements of that residue. So the map underneath is the unlabeled, and then in color are shown the densities arising from the gold cluster. So this is at fairly low resolution, but the central position of the gold cluster is really quite well defined, and so you can define the conformational changes quite nicely. And on the basis of such cryo-EM experiments, as well as fluorescence resonance energy transfer and EPR spectroscopy, this kind of model has been proposed for the precessive movement of kinesin heads on microtubules with ATP hydrolysis. I'm glad that one showed. Something that won't be presented at the course is tomography, and this is work from Dick McIntosh's lab in Colorado. It's a very powerful technique for looking at cell structure. This is a Z-series, and they're also developing algorithms to define and demarcate organelles, defining edges and boundaries. And with that kind of technique, you can examine the, for instance, the Golgi apparatus, as you see here. In this study, they're examining pancreatic beta cells, trying to understand what's different in diabetes with vesicle export. Even more elaborate here, so you can distinguish all the filaments, objects about the right size of ribosomes, microtubules, mitochondria, and so on. And the latest, of course, is systems biology. And I obtained this from Gaudens, who's able to perform real-time imaging of, and by selecting the wavelength, you can examine different molecules and start to look at their interaction in living cells. And then they're able to plot vectors according to where the speckles are moving and understand mathematically the dynamics within cells, the forces during movement, and all the interactions. It's really quite exciting. So here it would be the interaction of cytoplasmic actin with focal adhesions and vinculin interacting with integrins. Well, now I'll present some examples of structures like icosahedral viruses. And this is an example of reovirus, which Tim Baker has worked on for many years. The native particle shown in blue, which binds to receptors and can undergo endocytosis. There's another pathway where this blue protein undergoes cleavage, and there's a conformational change in a surface spike, which binds to a receptor and also internalized. Within internal endosomes, there can be a proteolysis and release of different protein shells, and then this particle, in fact, is transcriptionally active. This is a comparison of those final core particles shown in gold, here in negative state and here in the frozen hydrated state, and it highlights the wonderful contrast that you achieve in negative state. You can see these surface turrets quite nicely. On the other hand, remember that this is dried, whereas we preserve native structure here. A challenge that we're always faced with is the low contrast, and we use judicious defocusing in order to increase the contrast in the micrographs. Something that you'll be hearing about is use of the projection theorem in three-dimensional reconstruction. And the idea is that in your projection views, those are different orientations of the three-dimensional object. And then you compute the diffraction patterns. And the challenge then is to merge the diffraction patterns properly in the correct angular relationship so that you can compute an inverse Fourier transform to derive the three-dimensional structure. One advantage of studying icosahedral viruses is their very high symmetry. With 60-fold symmetry, the Fourier transform of a virus has lines along which the Fourier transform has the same value. So these are called common lines. And in fact, from one virus particle, you can compute a three-dimensional map. So we take full advantage of the high symmetry in viruses to examine their structure. And here's a plot of orientation angles theta and phi. And the idea is to fill out this space so that you sample all orientations in computing the three-dimensional structure. And this is a low-resolution map of those gold particles, the reovirus core. And here, even at low resolution, you get an idea of overall size and shape, geometry, the quaternary arrangement of the subunits. These are the five-fold pentamers, the vertex. And you can also examine different conformational states. This is an analysis by Kelly Dryden of the native virion, this infectious subviral particle, and the core particle. And in moving from the virion to the ISVP, there's release of that outer layer. And then in moving from this particle to this particle, there's proteolysis of these red subunits, the mu1 subunits, and a dramatic conformational change in the pentamer so that these subunits swing up and out to open this channel. As I said, these core particles are transcriptionally active, and so that we can capture conformational states by cryo-EM. And the idea here was to incubate core particles with nucleotides, incubate at 37 degrees, freeze rapidly, and so we were able to trap the core particles as they were synthesizing RNA. You see these threads of density on the perimeter of the particles, which is newly synthesized single-stranded RNA. In these cross-section views of the inactive and the active core particles, you do see this additional density here within that turret, and we feel that as the mRNA exits the particle, it retains icosahedral symmetry so that we can reinforce the density here, but then as it exits beyond the perimeter, you lose the symmetry, so it's smeared out in the reconstruction. And surface views of the active particle, you can see this additional density that we ascribe to the exiting RNA. So another advantage of cryo-EM is that with the idea of using the rapid freezing technique, where you freeze in, you know, a couple of milliseconds, you can trap metastable functionally important states. In fact, you can time the freezing to look at kinetics and a series of intermediates. Here's one other example of rotavirus. It's about 1,000 angstroms in diameter. It's the main cause of infant death, like causing sort of a cholera-like illness, severe diarrhea, dehydration. And this is an example of using difference map analysis, where the structure of the intact particle, and then you can also release these surface spikes just by adjustment of the pH, and then compute a difference map, and you can see how clean the difference map is in delineating the surface spike. And because we derive the full three-dimensional structure, we can take the 3D volume and examine the internal structure, internal layers, and in this case, there are three protein shells, blue, violet, and red, and the surface spikes, the hemagglutinin, which binds to receptors on susceptible cells. You'll be hearing that antibody labeling can be used to identify epitopes and also localize domains within structures. This is an example from Kelly Dryden and Mariana Tahova, where they labeled the virus with neutralizing antibodies, and you can define location of where the hypervariable loops interact with the surface spike. I also wanted to show this example from Tim Baker's lab. He's been studying an enveloped virus. Alpha viruses have a lipid bilayer envelope with an external capsid shell, surface spikes, and an internal capsid shell. And this map is at fairly low resolution, probably about 25 angstroms or so, but there's sufficient definition, and you can see the head group layers in the lipid bilayer. And there's obviously close interaction between the glycoprotein spikes and the lipid bilayer. This is a cross-section view of a very low resolution reconstruction, just 50 angstroms. And now by analysis of thousands of particles, they've been able to extend the resolution to about 10. And you can see all the detail. In fact, these threads that you see across the lipid bilayer are an alpha helical coil. So as I told you before, we can use pseudoatomic modeling to build an atomic structure for the virus. Here's the lipid bilayer, those threads of density, the external glycoprotein, and now the crystal structure is docked in place, and you can see how the coil docks in very nicely to the density that you see. I also wanted to show this example from Kelly's work of hepatitis virus. This is interesting because it has an icosahedral core in blue, and it is also enveloped, but the surface spikes are not packed with icosahedral symmetry. So this is an example where you have an icosahedral internal structure and then a lipid bilayer, and the surface spikes have quasi-hexagonal packing, but they're not precisely in icosahedral symmetry. And the red is the double-stranded DNA, which interacts closely with the inner surface of the capsid so that part of the genome is organized with icosahedral symmetry, as you see. Using rapid freezing, we can trap intermediates in virus assembly. This is a project with Jack Johnson where we were able to identify a procapsid in the assembly of this tetravirus called N-omega-V. And by adjustment of the pH, there's a dramatic conformational change from this circular open structure to a very closed angular capsid that's with no holes at all. Here you see holes fenestrating the surface. And because a crystal structure is known for this mature particle, we can take those subunits and then dock them into the density of the procapsid and start to understand the chemistry of the interactions here. Moving on to single particle analysis, I'll give a couple of examples. Earlier this year, Francisco's group, Francisco Asturias, published this very nice analysis of fatty acid synthase. And so it's about a 270 KD complex. It's pretty small, down around 120 angstroms or so. And they used spider and random conical tilt methods to derive three-dimensional structures. And here is shown a cluster analysis where you assume that the particles that you're imaging may have different conformations. Here, let's say 8 or 9. And you group them into those that are similar to each other, multivariate statistical analysis. So for instance, this was the most populated, this was the least populated. This was the wild type fatty acid synthase. And then in a separate experiment, they examined a mutant that was also in the presence of substrates and NADH. And what they found is that in the wild type, if you examine these, they have a lot of different appearances. So the structure is probably breathing, probably has multiple conformational states, but then in the presence of substrates and cofactors, it locks down into a unique conformation. So it says something about the enzymology of the particle, this complex. And there are a couple of different models proposed for how it's organized. So it's a dimer, and one model is that you simply have two chains that are adjacent to each other. And then a competing model is that, in fact, the two chains are intertwined. And obviously, this globular kind of structure supports the model where the two chains are intertwined in a complicated fashion. To sort that out, Francisco's group is using gold labeling. I previously showed you the analysis of microtubules and movements in NCD by using gold labeling, a much larger structure with helical symmetry, microtubule. Here it's a single particle analysis, sort of 120 angstroms. And yet you can clearly see additional density due to the additional gold. So the protein was HIS-tagged. And so you can use just chelate the nickel with a gold cluster and separately examine those particles. The difference map is shown here. So the additional density that you see here and here is absent here, for instance. And these are back projections of just the wild type of the three-dimensional map for comparison. So even in such small particles, you're able to identify gold clusters on the order of 15, 20 angstroms, really quite remarkable. And it will clearly be important in trying to sort out how the two chains interact in the enzyme complex. The other single particle project I wanted to describe is work of Brian Adair on integrins. Many of you, I'm sure, know that they're involved in diverse cellular processes, development, angiogenesis, wound healing, cancer, thrombosis. They also function as virus receptors. I actually like this website. It gives all these cell pathways, shows how complicated it all is, and the crosstalk between integrins and GPCRs. So it's mediated by a MAP kinase, ERK kinase pathway. Integrins are heterodimeric complexes, about 250 kD. There's an alpha chain and a beta chain. Single transmembrane span and short cytoplasmic tails, this large ectodomain. And a variety of models have been proposed for how signaling has occurred, how signaling takes place across the membrane. It's interesting that you can bind a ligand externally, and that elicits a conformational change which alters the conformation on the cytoplasmic face, which confers the ability for phosphorylation and downstream signaling. Alternatively, you can bind cytoskeletal proteins, as we saw previously from Gowden's work, like vinculin, and that elicits a transmembrane conformational change which alters the affinity for ligand on the extracellular surface. There's a great deal of interest in understanding the conformational contortions that the molecule undergoes during outside-in and inside-out signaling. There are a number of drugs targeted to integrins, and in fact, we use antibodies ReoPro in high-risk angioplasty. Brian Adair purified the intact molecule with the transmembrane domains from platelets and could bind a toxin that blocks the integrin, converts it to an active conformation, and in this gel shift assay, clearly showed that in this state he has the inactive form, low affinity form, and here in the presence of the snake venom toxin, the high affinity form. And so I'll just describe some of his experiments on this low affinity form. Well, I just wanted to describe the consequence of integrin activation. This is a white cell integrin. I told you previously about the white cell interrogating the vessel wall here. And then when you activate the integrin, you can see the clustering of white cells. Now, the same thing would take place with platelet thrombosis if you have a tear in your artery or if a clot forms during a heart attack. You have this platelet plug that blocks the artery. Shown here are raw particle images that Brian recorded. Again, these are fairly defocused in order to increase the contrast. This is frozen hydrated, so there's no stain here. And remember that these objects are sort of 150 angstroms. They're really quite small. And the idea is to group similar views. So you'll analyze thousands of particles, sort them into those that statistically appear the same, and then you'll average those. Those are called class averages, as you see here. And there's an increase in clarity in moving from a single raw particle image to, say, 100 particles that have been averaged. And then the relative orientation of the different class averages has to be sorted out so that you can derive a three-dimensional map. And the map can be back projected in the same orientations, theta phi orientations, as your raw particles and class averages. And obviously, they should look the same. So that in moving from the raw particle to the class average to the map projection, there's an increase in clarity, and obviously the shape is the same as it should be. And so a method that's commonly used in single particle analysis is to have a starting model that you compute projections from, shown here as the shadows, and then you align your raw images with the model projections, and that allows you to determine the orientation angles of your experimental particles. With that, you can then derive a three-dimensional map, and as you include more particles, you'll increase the resolution and have increased definition of molecular details. So comparing this starting model to the experimental map, you're starting to see this sort of angular feature here. And then this is repeated using this as the next model for the round of refinement. The way the maps, the map resolution is determined is to take the most objective way is to actually solve the structure twice with independent data sets. And then you examine the correlation between the two maps in reciprocal space, in Fourier space. You compute the Fourier transform, and that's in shells, moving to higher and higher resolution. So as the noise increases, there'll be no correlation. And arbitrarily, a value of about 0.5 is set as a cutoff for estimating map resolution. And here, it's about 20 angstroms or so. This is a gallery of views of the map that Brian determined, and I have to say, when he pulled this up on the screen, there were a few laughs from other members of the group, whether he's looking at a chicken leg or some alien. But he soldiered on to interpret the map, as you see here, with this larger density being interpreted as the ectodomain. This red density is the cytoplasmic domains. And surprisingly, there was this intervening rod of density that you see here. And we were uncertain whether this was a real feature, and so Brian deleted this from the map, used this as a starting model, and sure enough, this reappeared. So we have some confidence that this is a real feature. So even though the map is at low resolution, this tube of density is about the right size for two transmembrane alpha helices. So Brian examined the alpha chain transmembrane domains, beta chain, and Mark Ginsberg identified an ion pair, here the arginine and aspartic acid, which allowed Brian to set the register for defining helical wheels for the transmembrane domains. And you all remember that you can have left-handed and right-handed coiled coils. And this is a representation of the helical wheel in the left-handed case, with the ion pair identifying the vertical register of the two helices. And the yellow residues are those that are conserved in the two chains. In this case, the conserved residues are sort of sprinkled around the perimeter of the helices. In the right-handed case, you can see there's a concentration of the conserved residues at the interface. And so the idea was that in the low affinity state, the helices associate as a right-handed coiled coil. And we were pleased to see this analysis much more sophisticated using molecular dynamics simulation, where they also concluded that the transmembrane domains were similar to glycophorin A, which is a right-handed coiled coil. Well, more recently, a crystal structure of the ectodomain of a related integrin, alpha V beta 3, was solved in Amin Arnaud's lab at Harvard. And one of the surprises is that the membrane proximal part of the structure was folded back against the ligand binding domain, so it was sort of jackknifed back. And this was a big surprise. Nevertheless, it did give high-resolution structures for the 12 individual components comprising the ectodomain. And so Brian was able to take those structures and, knowing the connectivity and where the membrane starts, dock that into the map of the integrin. There's a very good fit in the head domain. The fit was uncertain in this stalk region, but in the ligand binding region, it was really quite good. So this is the crystal structure, the EM structure, intact molecule with the transmembrane domains. And this is just a hypothetical activated molecule that presumably would be extended and unbent. And the goal is to understand the conformational changes that take place when ligand is bound. And obviously, we need both the crystallography and also the electron microscopy. More recently, Tim Springer's group at Harvard examined the association between the cytoplasmic domains in living cells. In the low affinity state and the high affinity state, these are their sort of hypothetical models. And the important observation is that in the low affinity state, they actually did see energy transfer, and upon binding extracellular or cytoplasmic ligands, they lost the signal. And so it's consistent with our results that the cytoplasmic domains are associated in the low affinity state. Well, now let me carry on with analysis of 2D crystals. I'll describe three examples: retroviral capsid protein, gap junction channels, and aquaporins. And here I show a schematic of three different ways to generate two-dimensional crystals. In this in situ method, the material that you isolate from your cell may already be at high concentration, and the approach is to use low concentrations of detergent to extract lipid, concentrate the protein in the plane of the bilayer, and if you're lucky, form two-dimensional crystals. Nigel Unwin's analysis of the acetylcholine receptor would fall into this category, where the channels are already fairly crystalline when they're isolated from the torpedo fish. In this example, in vitro reconstitution, the membrane protein is purified in detergent solution, and you add detergent-solubilized lipids, and you remove the detergent by dialysis. And under this condition, lipid bilayers will form spontaneously, and you adjust the lipid-protein ratio so that there's a very high concentration of protein in the reconstituted membrane. And again, if you're lucky, you're able to form two-dimensional crystals. And the last approach I'll describe is monolayer crystallization, where this would be a lipid monolayer, as you see here. This would be, say, a histagged protein, and you dope your monolayer with nickel lipid so that there is a specific interaction between your protein and the bilayer, so that you concentrate the protein within the plane, and again, if you're lucky, you can form 2D crystals. And this statement from Ephraim Racker was published actually when I was a postdoc. So, urge a student who is interested in the structure and function of membrane protein to learn the tools of biochemistry, biophysics, and molecular biology. Clues to the mode of action can be obtained by site-directed mutagenesis, and any free time on Saturdays and holidays should be devoted to crystallization. Scientists who plan such a tedious, dull, and perhaps fruitless project is well advised to delete it from the grant or hide it behind a screen of glittering experience on site-directed mutagenesis. So as you know, the number of crystal structures, X-ray structures, of membrane proteins continues to increase. There are about 50 now, and I still think this is an exciting and emerging field. This is one of your handouts. I won't go through this in detail, but it's sort of a general comparison of X-ray crystallography and electron microscopy of 2D crystals. And as you know, 3D crystallography can require tens of milligrams. Of course, if you're unable to grow 2D crystals, that can require tens of milligrams too. But if you know the conditions, typically not much material is required. And this is routinely, in the presence of detergents, you can use cubic lipids, but for the most part, 3D crystals are grown in detergents, whereas we're able to examine membrane proteins in their native lipid bilayer. And this is important for many membrane proteins, which are really quite labile when they're extracted in detergent. 2D crystals is what I'll be describing, but I also told you about work on single particles, such as the integrin. So there's a lot of potential for that to obtain information about membrane proteins. And so here, the goal is high resolution. Intermediate resolution can be achieved fairly commonly now. And of course, we can trap intermediates by freezing. And with X-ray crystallography, it's a bit more difficult because you have to grow crystals. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so the crystal exists within the lipid bilayer. Yeah. I'll show you a couple of examples. Let me first just describe the example where it's not in the lipid bilayer. So here, this would be a soluble domain. This could be a soluble protein. It could be, say, the ectodomain of the integrin, which was histagged, that binds to the monolayer. And in this instance, Barbie Ganser examined a retroviral capsid protein. Here you see the retrovirus budding from a cell with a unique conical shape of HIV. This is a view onto, this is a helical crystal, and the individual domains within the capsid protein have been solved by X-ray crystallography, and this is the interpretation of how they would exist within the crystal. Now, what Barbie did was generate a histide construct of a murine leukemia virus capsid protein. And this is a view looking down onto the lipid monolayer with the bound protein. So the histide protein binds the nickel lipid, and she was able to grow these very large crystals. So originally performed by Eric Barkless. And this is a comparison of the murine leukemia virus structure with the HIV capsid, showing complementarity in this hexagonal arrangement with these linkers to the adjacent subunits. The last two examples are membrane proteins within lipid bilayers. And the first is an example of the in situ crystallization method. Here I'll use Vincent Unger's work on the gap junction channel. Gap junctions form at the interface between cells where the membranes come into close apposition, and you have a hemi channel in one cell that docks with a hemi channel in an adjacent cell to form this central conduit, as you see here. And they have sort of hexagonal packing when you isolate them from cells, and by using low concentrations of detergent, you can concentrate the channels and generate better crystals. We're interested in these channels because they're related to current flow in the heart, and this is a lethal rhythm called ventricular fibrillation. And in this patient, they were fortunately countershocked, and the rhythm was restored. And all the electrical activity you see here is mediated by gap junction channels. So Pepe's video did work here. You see these vortices of current flow in this voltage-sensitive dye. So here there's on the right is the normal dye flow during contraction, but when you have these current vortices, there's no effective contraction of the muscle. And we've been studying this isoform of connexins called connexin 43. You can see the conservation in these transmembrane domains. And they're not just inert conduits, but respond to a number of physiological states. And in muscle, they reside in these high contrast lines called intercalated discs. This is a schematic of their assembly pathway targeted to the plasma membrane, where they coalesce and then dock with channels in the opposing cell. And in their turnover, interestingly, this interaction is so tight that you pull out part of the plasma membrane of the adjacent cell to form this connexosome. This is work from Matthias Falk showing that the gap junctions in cells can be several microns in size when the protein is overexpressed here in HeLa cells. But they're not static structures, they're really quite fluid. Matthias expressed two different isoforms colored differently with CFP and YFP, and you can see them melting together and moving in the membrane. This is another example of how they can intersperse within the plasma membrane. And in this analysis, Matthias labeled connexin 43 with CFP, and tubulin is shown in green. You can see the transport vesicles. It's really quite remarkable. They move 0.2 to 1 microns a second. So it's a very dynamic process. And these channels turn over about every 5 hours in your heart. These were some early crystals. You can see the hexagonal arrangement, the hexagonal diffraction, low resolution structure showing the docking end to end. And then we were able to express the protein in BHK cells, which allowed us to generate channels, gap junction plaques, with a single molecular species, which improved the resolution. And they're still functional as a recombinant protein here. The cell was injected, and in the open state, you can see movement of dye to adjacent cells, and when the channels are closed, there's no dye transfer. This is a comparison of the diffraction pattern in negative stain, and then Vincent's froze the crystals, and you can see this remarkable increase in the resolution of the data. Here this is about 20 angstroms resolution in stain, extending to about 7 angstroms. And these circular densities correspond to alpha helices viewed end on. This is a side view of the channel. These rods of density are the alpha helices. He then went on to extend the resolution to about 5.7. And in the extracellular gap, there's much more definition. And the current idea is that these densities here are too close together to be alpha helices. Alpha helices pack at about separation of about 10 angstroms. And with these densities being this close, the idea is that they may be threads of beta sheet. And this is a view of the 5.7 angstrom structure, where you see these rods of density corresponding to alpha helices. So there's 6 subunits in each hemichannel. They dock end to end, so you have a dodecamer. And slicing down through the map, you can see within the membrane interior the 24 alpha helices. Looking down the barrel into the extracellular gap, there's this continuous wall of protein, so that the cytoplasm of the two cells is in communication, but there's no diffusion of electrolytes and metabolites to the extracellular space. And to interpret that map, Vincenz noticed in the structure that there are a couple of phenylalanines, one helical turn apart. So in the transmembrane domains, you'll see bulky aromatic groups, but only in M4 do you see these two phenylalanines close to the extracellular side. That was a key observation. And those two residues would be here. And if you look at the map, there's this shoulder of density. A similar shoulder of density was seen in the low-resolution map of bacteriorhodopsin. Similar situation where you had two aromatic groups, one helical turn apart. And so at low resolution, that density is smeared out. And that's one way to interpret that shoulder that allows us to assign M4 in the map. In collaborating with Cyril Fleischmann and Nirben Tal, we were also able to use the same approach for GPCRs, where you look at conservation of residues amongst the gene family of connexins. And this gray face that you see along the lumen of the pore is where there's most variability in M3, which has been shown biochemically to be the pore lining helix. And then on M4, there's also a hypervariable face, and so that allows us to assign and also determine the rotation of M1 and M3 and M4. Well, having assigned the helices within the map and their rotation, we can build a C-alpha model. And most recently, we've been able to look at genetic disorders involving another isoform called connexin 26. And since we have a C-alpha model, we don't know where the side chains are, but we can identify the location of the mutations. And that's shown in this top view of the channel. Obviously, the alpha helices and the red residues are sites where mutations have been known to occur. The observation is that almost all the mutations are at helix-helix interfaces, that only a couple are on the lumen of the pore, and in fact those mutations are well tolerated, and on the perimeter you see very few. So occurring at protein-protein interfaces, you can see how these mutations would disrupt the formation and assembly of the channels, and it may provide some insight into some of the genetic diseases related to connexins. The last project I'll describe is on aquaporins. And this is another example where the membrane protein is incorporated within the lipid bilayer. And aquaporins are present in a variety of tissues. They're involved in maintaining clarity of the lens. You'll hear about aquaporin in the lens from Thomas Valtz later in the meeting. And we've examined an aquaporin from red blood cells, erythrocytes. It's quite abundant, AQP1. Of course, you all know that Peter Agre received half of the Nobel Prize for the discovery of water channels. And they're integral membrane proteins, tetrameric. Interestingly, unlike gap junctions, each subunit in the tetramer has a pore. So the there are four water channels within the tetrameric oligomer. This is a I thought it was interesting to look back at the history of the discovery of aquaporins. Peter Auger was a hematologist at Johns Hopkins. He was working on Rh proteins, trying to purify them from red cells. And there was a contaminant, and he decided to work on the contaminant, and it turns out that that was AQP1. And he took the mRNA and expressed it in oocytes, and sure enough, he found that it influenced water permeability, as you see here. So this top oocyte does not have the RNA, whereas the bottom one does, and you can see it's starting to explode. It's osmotically sensitive. As I said, they're present in a number of tissues. And shown here is the topology, where helix 1 is homologous to 4, 2 to 5, and 3 to 6. So there's this internal symmetry in the sequence, and the it's thought to have arisen by gene duplication. Also characteristic are these so-called NPA boxes on either side of the membrane. As you'll see, they're important for water transport. These are crystals that Alok Mitra grew, again, by reconstitution of detergent-solubilized protein with detergent-solubilized lipids, removing the lipids, and these nice crystals were generated. And the diffraction patterns here extended, in this case, to 2.87. This is Anchi Cheng's map at about 6 angstroms resolution, looking down the top. So this is one monomer, 2, 3, and 4, and this crescentic shape is the entrance to the pore. And these colored rods identify the alpha helices. So moving on to higher resolution, this is a side view of Anchi's map. And remember I said that the sequence probably arose by gene duplication. If you just take a section within the membrane here and a section of density here and you superimpose them, they don't superimpose at all. But if you take this section and flip it over and then superimpose it, you can see that they correspond nicely. And it shows that there's a quasi-twofold axis of symmetry within the bilayer, and it's consistent with the idea that you have this internal symmetry in the amino acid sequence. So the concept is that here a water channel really doesn't care about sitedness. It doesn't care if the water moves from outside inside or inside outside. It just makes the membrane act like a dialysis membrane. And so it's very efficient at doing that by just duplicating itself. Gary Wren and Alok then went on to record tilted diffraction patterns from tilted crystals here at 55 degrees. It's often the case that when you tilt the crystal, the diffraction will fade out as a consequence of movement and charging. And this is a gorgeous pattern. You plot out the data with tilt angle and can merge that to derive three-dimensional maps, as you'll hear about. Several groups have gone on by electron crystallography and X-ray crystallography to solve the high-resolution structures of aquaporins. And I colored the helices here according to those that are homologous, 1, 4, 2, 5, 3, 6. And then in this side view, in red are the NPA boxes. So there are these hemihelices at the tips of which are the NPA boxes in the center of the pore. This is one monomer. And so in the last slide, on the basis of structures like this, models have been suggested for how water moves. And the idea is that they form dipoles. The dipole of the water molecule allows them to arrange themselves across the bilayer. And in the region of the MPA box, the proton wire is disrupted. And that's important because you want water molecules to pass, but not protons. So protons are, of course, you have the hydronium, and the proton is passed along the proton wire. And so by disrupting the proton wire, you exclude protons from moving across the bilayer, and you only allow water molecules. And it was on the basis of this idea that Peter Agre received the Nobel Prize, and also for his discovery of aquaporins. And this points out that you don't have to be first author or senior author to get the Nobel Prize. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark. Amazing effort to bring the 70 movies. So I'm sure Mark would be very happy to answer questions. Go ahead.
What happens, Trevor, if you have a two-dimensional array rather than a two-dimensional crystal? So that if you've got a particle that has some reorientation that can take place in that domain.
Well, the analysis would be the same. In fact, there are proteins that will form platelets. One of the best examples is catalase, which Nigel examined some time ago. So under certain conditions, you can get formation of two-dimensional arrays, two-dimensional crystals, just of protein. Well, if the molecules are in register in the crystal, then it would be equivalent to having any other two-dimensional crystal. Now, it could also be the case that they're disordered, in which one molecule is not in register with the adjacent one. Either it's not on the lattice, or it's actually rotated. So there's sort of two kinds of disorder, and two general kinds of disorder in 2D crystals. Here you have the lattice, and then you have the molecules packed in the lattice. So you can have lattice disorder, where the actual lattice varies. And in fact, we take that into account in the image processing, where we can, quote, straighten or unbend the crystals computationally to increase the resolution. So that's lattice disorder. And then substitution disorder is where you have the molecules, and they're on the lattice points. The lattice is perfect, we'll say. But the molecules may rotate, or the molecules may be heterogeneous, but on the lattice point. So that would be substitution disorder.
An extreme example would be where they're just tightly packed into a membrane and there's no relationship between a filter.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. But the background is called packed.
Right.
Right. In which case you couldn't do the crystal approach.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are instances just like that where a protein may pack closely but not be in a crystal. And so you can box out those individual particles and use single particle techniques. I showed you one example of Kelly's analysis of hepatitis virus. There's that outer shell with the spikes. The spikes are sort of quasi-hexagonally packed. And we think the curvature is induced by random insertion of pentamers to generate the closed shell. But there, it's not a crystallographic lattice.
So, if you don't need an ideal packing, does it mean that the sample format of AFM is the same as...
I'm sorry, say that.
Does it mean that sample preparation for AFM is the same as...
You could use the same sample for AFM. Yeah, so for instance, there are people... Alex McPherson is using AFM to look at the surface structure of some viruses, retroviruses. The resolution is really quite low, though, because you saw how huge the tip is relative to your particle. And I gave a couple of the best examples of 2D crystal analysis for bacteriorhodopsin and the aquaporins from Andreas Engel. Again, you look at surface topography and don't get internal structure. Yeah, the specimen would be the same, though. You could take the same specimen that he put on his mica and actually put it on a grid and freeze it. Yeah.
Where do the lipids show up in either the 2D analysis or in the case of the single
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I showed you Tim Baker's analysis of the alpha virus, where the bilayer, in fact, is bent and conforms to icosahedral symmetry. And there, with averaging, you can literally see the density within the head group regions on the two sides. And in Nigel's analysis of the acetylcholine receptor, you can also see the higher density demarcating the head group regions of the bilayer. In detergent, of course, the head group of the detergent doesn't have the scattering power of the phosphate head group. But more importantly, it's probably because the detergent bubble, the detergent micelle, is too disordered. And lastly, the resolution is much lower. So in Tim's analysis of the alpha virus, that was sort of 10 angstroms. Same for Nigel's early maps of the acetylcholine receptor. The head group regions were showing up at sort of 10 angstroms, thereabouts. I suppose you can ask the question, so why don't we see the head group regions for the aquaporins or the gap junctions? And I think it's a consequence of the comparatively low resolution. You'll hear from Thomas Valtz about a high-resolution structure of AQP0, in which case they can see lipid molecules bound to the surface of the protein. So not only do you see the head group, you can actually see the aliphatic chains and, you know, a bulky aromatic group in between the two tails. So at high resolution, you can see the lipids very nicely. In fact, I believe that that's the first crystal structure of a membrane. Ron?
So there are a couple of examples now where membrane protein has been solved at high resolution by X-ray crystallography and by electron microscopy. And we, as electron microscopists, probably think that the EM structure is more physiologically relevant. Is there any evidence for any difference in the protein between the two structures?
I'm sure Vincent can chime in here too, because the best example I know of is rhodopsin. Where there's a lot of controversy about the structure of the surface loops, and that's been solved by X-ray, EM, and also interrogated extensively by EPR spectroscopy. The point is, it's very important to examine the protein in its native lipid environment. Bridget. How much time do we have? Yeah, I think this question will be heard throughout the meeting. It's like, what are the barriers to extending this technology? And it's usually the specimen and the imaging. I think that the processing techniques are very robust now. For instance, if you have a 2D crystal that diffracts to 3 angstroms, you can solve the structure. Didn't point out that with electron microscopy, we record images, so we compute the phases. So our phase errors are much lower than, say, with X-ray crystallography. And the same for icosahedral. So even there, Tim's analysis, and you'll hear from Hua Chu that you know, it's down to sort of 6 angstroms, 5 angstroms, and coming along very nicely. And even for single particles, if they're large, then the resolution is certainly continuing to increase. But I think that part of the barrier is just the size. That you know, Francisco's analysis of the fatty acid synthase, that's sort of 270 kD, and Brian's analysis of the integrin, it's 250 kD. I think it'll be very difficult to push the resolution in instances like that, unless you can form a 2D crystal. But looking at single particles, it's the signal-to-noise problem, as we all know. In terms of imaging, I think our vexations are the same as they've been for years, where you have beam damage, and you have beam-induced movement and charging. I'm sure there are several people that would like to contribute what they think is most important in limiting the resolution of our technique. I think that's a good point. Vincent's pointed out that in a 3D crystal, crystal packing can alter the structure, but of course it's high resolution, so you get at least part of what we hope is the authentic structure at high resolution.
Well, it kind of holds the particles into a conformation.
Yeah. One example I know of is James Conway and Alistair's analysis of the hepatitis core capsid, where James was processing thousands of particles, and then I think in his final data set he limited to 800 or so, and the very, very, very best particles, the particles that agreed with each other the best, and then was able to break 10 angstroms.
That's an important distinction.
That's right. That's right.
In a couple instances using gold particles and the tag, I'm just curious, I mean, how is that technique well developed and does gold work?
I'll put in my 2 cents and then let Ron and Francisco answer, because We've tried gold labeling in a couple of experiments, and the problems, say with 2D crystals, is that the chemistry of the labeling may disrupt your 2D crystal, or the site you're trying to label may not be accessible. But there are some excellent examples. Ron's analysis of microtubules and Francisco's analysis of fatty acid synthase, and Alistair's analysis of the hepatitis, where they could take the recombinant proteins, label those, and then assemble particles. But that was on the interior, so if they assembled the particle and then tried to label it, it didn't work. So it's, I think it's a difficult technique. Well, the phosphine shell makes it sort of 15 or...
But I know of lots of unsuccessful.
Francisco, do you know of any other examples? I think yours is the only one. That one point here is that scattering of electrons is not proportional to molecular weight as it is for X-rays. is much lower. Consequently, so we have to use, say, a dozen gold atoms in order to see it. But at high resolution, you can resolve individual mercuries, for instance. Yeah, that's a great question. I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion about that too. You know, often we're limited in the amount of data we have, so we're very reluctant to like exclude part of it. But yeah, in the best examples, you'll actually leave out part of your data. And then see how that compares with the final structure. In some instances, for computing resolution in single particle analysis, people would simply randomly divide their particles in half. So they'd solve the structure, and then they'd, after the fact, go back and then divide it into two data sets. And I think that's limited because it's the same data. You're not actually excluding data, so I think it's much more robust to independently solve the structure and then see how the two maps compare. Kelly has certainly done that for virus structures, and it's interesting, you know, same micrographs, selecting different particles, keep them separate, and some of them refine faster than others. Hopefully they converge on the same solution, though. David? Vincent, do you want to comment? Because he wrote an article for OctoCrist, wasn't it? On sort of quality control in 2D crystallography. Yes. Nigel, I'm curious if you have any comments on quality control in the acetylcholine receptor analysis.
Well, of course, once you get to the resolution where you can resolve the peptide chain, you can compare your densities with the densities that you can calculate by
Mm.
But you know, I noticed when you asked the point, you said it was quite interesting. It's like, for instance, in the membrane, there we have densities come across so that in the middle of the biolayer. It seemed that at low resolution, that's a good solid density there. But then you go to near atomic resolutions, and that density in the middle of the membrane disappears. It doesn't hold up in the middle. And the hole is 6 angstroms in diameter. So it's only that when you get to higher resolution, even it's high resolution on 6 angstroms, you can actually see that part. So, you know, you have to say, instead of looking like the side chains coming and blocking up the core in that region, you have to say that there's not actually doing that. So, so I must say, as we've gone to higher resolution, we've sort of looked back. You know, you can explain why you said what you said earlier on, even though it wasn't strictly correct. I mean, that's what you should be able to do as you get better and better structures, explain what went wrong in the past and your interpretation.
Any other questions? Well, they were very good questions.
Mm.
And I'd really like to give Mark a big... Oh, you had another question?
Just
well allowed.
Sure.
Well, a simple question. You mentioned gold staining or discards or whatever. What about the proteins without their tags? Can you use radioactivity or phosphorylation or whatever to mark? I don't know, the technology is so advanced nowadays.
Yeah. The issue is, what other labeling methods are there besides gold and iridium? And what chemistry? So the...
Radioactivity.
Yeah, so radioactivity.
Phosphorylation.
Well, you can engineer it in a little domain. You could put in an SH3 domain into a loop, or you could put in something, put in a GFP, for example, and localize that.
I was wondering about the phosphorylation of proteins.
There are, you know, some antibodies that recognize phosphates, so that may be one approach.
Yeah, just simple.
About that, some proteins can be marked by only the action of antibodies, and antibodies can be seen by cryo-EM without any other marking. So you can see where the antibody is located without.
David?
Well, there's some talk, I don't know that anyone's done it, but you can use energy loss spectroscopy in electron microscopes to locate particular kinds of atoms. So people do it. They're looking for calcium in metals.
The best example that I know of in that technology was called ballistocardiography by Stan Bullivant, in which he was trying to look at calcium in the heart because it's so important for contraction. And he rigged up a rifle with the beating heart, and he timed the trigger with systole and diastole. And so he shot the shell, the capsule, it went through the heart and then was frozen. So he could trap that and then suction it and look in the microscope. Ballistocardiography.
Is this something you do on your patients?
I don't think there's a billing code for that. So.